This is CliffCentral.com.
Dirk Herman is the chief executive of the Solidariteit Trade Union. Thanks for coming in to see us.
Thank you very much.
Sure. I've been sort of watching what you guys have been doing over the last couple of years, and it's interesting what you've been involved in. And a lot of people have tried to peg you guys down as some kind of, you know, white-only right-wing organization, and they've found themselves scrambling for evidence of that. Yeah. When you do things like defend the girl who was accosted by Grace Mugabe,
yeah,
and things like that, I'm curious, do you find it difficult to get fair media representation for Solidariteit because people want to be bipolar about everything, that you're either a good guy or a bad guy, and depending on their own editorial take on things, you usually end up in the bad guy category. Do you struggle to get fair media representation?
I think it is difficult sometimes to have fair media coverage. I think it is because people still think in pre-94 kind of definitions that alt-right wing, and although we've changed a lot, I think after 1994, Solidarity had a challenge to position itself in a post-94 democracy. The fact of the matter is the trade union comes from a much more right-wing background. We were the mine workers union. The mine workers union was splash bang in the midst of the right-wing politics before 94. But the fact of the matter is, not only the right-wing side of the white community collapsed after 1994, also all that was linked to the old National Party collapsed in the past 94 era.
What we might have called center-right stuff those days.
I think one can call that, yes, center-right stuff. Yeah. And so suddenly we had a problem on how to survive. And that was just after 1994. And a bunch of young guys then started afresh. The fact is that the old mine workers union was literally bankrupt.
Was that the old white mine workers?
That was
union?
The old
white. Because there used to be a white mine workers union and a black one.
Yeah, the black one is today the National Union of Mine Workers, of
right,
course.
Which, of course, our current president, Cyril Ramaphosa, that's good,
yes,
has
he
his
was,
roots in.
He was the general secretary there. And yeah, that is why we still have a very good relationship with him, because of the interesting enough, and that's a paradox of our trade union roots. So the fact was then we had to reposition ourselves, and that was quite difficult to do. We were then, Flip Bayse was then general secretary in 1997. He was just over 30. I was then at that stage 26. And Kali Kruel then started also at the trade union first.
You guys were in your 20s.
We were in our 20s. And then we started this whole new thing. And we had the advantage of not too much experience. And so we sat there and Flip said, what we must do is to design a new kind of structure within the realities of the post-94 era. And I think that is what people simply does not understand, because they still try to define us according to all definitions, especially according to the apartheid definitions. Mm. And what we've deliberately done is to say, all right, let's look at the history of Afrikaners and let's see, where can we tap from? And then the interesting thing that we did was we found that we cannot tap from the apartheid era at all. So we can't be a continuation.
What do you mean? I mean, like, does that mean that it had no value in current politics for you?
The important thing there is that the apartheid era was a kind of a continuation of the central idea. Ironically, it was a bit of a continuation of the old imperial idea that the colonialist powers will manage all of. And that was a bit of continuation of that. Mm-hmm. Well, I see a bit of that today as well.
Like an authoritarian centrist autocratic sort of system.
Yeah, that's correct. And then we said, no, well, there was another time where one can tap, and I think all of South Africa can tap from, and that is the time after the Anglo-Boer War, after the Second World War, and the Depression times, and that's so on. And that was a time when the community played a tremendous role to tackle poverty, to tackle issues surrounding survival.
And workers' rights.
Workers' rights, etc. Yeah. Just a side note, that was the time of 1922 with the big strike. There was 200 members of ours were shot dead in that specific strike. It's 5 times more than Americana. It was a tremendous thing that happened with us as a trade union. And we started then in the post-1994 era to work with the idea of the community, the old help Makar idea.
I'm curious about that incident you just described, because certainly this is the first time I've heard of it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't fit the narrative of so many people on the left who like to say, well, our story is one of victimization and oppression. Oh, yeah. This is what white workers who were shot down during that strike.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was members of
By what? Smuts's government?
Smuts's government. That was a radical thing. And
200 people.
200 people shot dead in that specific incident. That was
Were they violent?
No. Well, the thing is that there was huge marches, and the interesting thing is the people that led the marches was the women on horses.
Oh, wow.
And so it was actually driven by the wives of the mine workers. And that was it's a tremendous kind of story that happened there. But there's an interesting thing about that as well. That specific strike of 1992, also called the Rand Revolt.
1922.
What did I say?
You said 92.
So. That will not work.
Just checking. Yeah. 1922, yeah.
That specific strike action was done by the Mine Workers Union on the one hand, and there was a nationalist element as well, but there was a socialist element in the Mine Workers Union at that time. And the interesting thing is they did it with the Communist Party of South Africa.
Well, that's not surprising, because the socialists and the leftists and the communists usually find themselves some fertile soil when they talk to mine workers and to anyone in hard labor, really, in difficult labor environments, unskilled labor particularly.
But just to say, context of time.
Yeah, it shows you how things have changed.
The Communist Party had a big banner that they used in that specific strike action. Not us. It was the Communist Party. And their banner was, "Workers of the world, unite for a white South Africa."
Wow. How things have changed.
Things have changed tremendously. No. Okay, but the point that I just wanted to make, that we went back, we jumped actually over the apartheid era, and we said, let's go and get some ideas from how a community can organize. And that is a powerful thing, because then suddenly you are free from the state. Although I'm so excited about what's happening at this stage in South Africa and that Zuma is out, etc., etc., we don't plan according to state. We say we plan according to the power of community, because we are quite convinced that the community is stronger than a state. So suddenly we could start to build new technical colleges. We could build a new university. We could organize communities that places help with local services. And that is, of course, local services for all.
All right. I don't think you're certainly not going to find an argument from me when it comes to people taking care of themselves and not relying on the state.
Yes.
I always think that the worst way of getting nothing done is to ask government to do it.
Yes.
And we're about to have a budget speech where the minister is no doubt going to tell us we all have to pay more tax. And what will probably happen is that more of that tax money will just be stolen and misappropriated and wasted.
Hmm.
So I'm not on the state side of things in any given situation, just because I don't really believe in the wisdom of mobs, and I don't see a parliamentary democracy as anything but a mob. However, there is this feeling, and this is where I want to really unpack this with you, and you can take it from me that I have respect for Afrikaans people, that I have respect for the way Afrikaans people have contributed to the country we live in. I'm very proud of my own Afrikaans ancestry, and I think that Afrikaans people deserve just as much as any other people in the world their space in the sun. So we're not going to have arguments about that, and I want you to have as much room as you need to explain this. I worry, though, about the fact that we might build lagers and we might build exclusivity into society. Why I worry about that is because it then gives people who don't really have a legitimate argument against communities standing up for themselves and getting things done, it gives them an excuse to say it's an us and them. Mm. And what they're trying to do is exclude everybody. Mm. And that's kind of where we get back into an apartheid kind of argument, because then it's us and it's them and there's different rules and different rights. And even though that's a misrepresentation of what I think you want to do, I need to be able to understand it as articulately as possible from you so that I don't end up in a situation where I'm misrepresenting your point of view or where you get misrepresented yet again, as you do in most media.
Yeah. All right. I think in the first place, what the strategy that we use is a strategy of bridging and bonding. And that is an old strategy that is used. The bonding side is to say that we are a community, and Afrikaners define themselves as a community, and they have a very strong sense of the collective community
and identity
historically.
Right.
And there's a very logic reason for that, because they use their community to fight the old imperial powers, and they use Afrikaans as an instrument for empowerment. So their aspiration went through their language and through their community. So they have a very strong sense of community. So that's bonding. But the risk of that is exactly what you say. Bonding and lagering is very near to each other.
And in our history, lagering has a very literal historical counterpoint in Blood River and those kinds of things too. So it's not just something that exists figuratively in the language. It was actually something that people used to do to protect themselves.
Yeah, and the other problem is, of course, this specific grouping that I'm talking about are a discredited community because of the apartheid era. So that is much more difficult.
And there
for
are
them.
Issues of guilt, and there are issues of all kinds of things that we can get into. But but carry on your argument. I didn't mean to interrupt.
So that is the bonding side. And now the challenge is, how do I do this without isolation? Mm-hmm. And that's why we believe so strong about bridging and bonding.
So what's bridging?
Bridging is to, as a community, then make sure that you are not isolated, that you reach out to other communities, other individuals, other structures, etc. And that we do quite aggressively. Let's take very practical examples. We helped to build the technical college in Marikana. We helped to build the technical college with the ANC government when it was still an ANC government in Port Elizabeth. We're now in discussions with NUMSA to help them to build the technical college. So we built and developed a college, and we said, let's use this as an example and carry it over. We have cooperation agreements with NUMSA. We have with NUM cooperation agreements.
So why would Solidaritate, for people who don't know anything about you, why would you want to build technical colleges? If someone who doesn't know Solidaritate and thinks you're a political organization, why would you build a technical college in Port Elizabeth? Explain that to people.
The very simple reason for that is that we believe that communities must take much more state self-responsibility, because the state, number one, is not supposed to do that, but in the second place, they can't. If you look at the state of technical colleges at the state in the public environment, it's an absolute crisis. So now we say you must take self-responsibility.
But is that because Solidaritate cares particularly about technical skills, about workers, about creating skilled labor? Is that an area of particular interest?
Well, of course.
You guys,
remember, Solidarity is primarily from the trade union environment. We have a whole movement around Solidarity. We call it the Solidarity Movement.
Right.
Every forum on the civil rights side, we have a helping hand that helps with poverty alleviation. We have, and then we have all this training institutions. And the reason why we focus so strong on training is for the simple reason that the biggest need for people at this stage in the world, according to Gallup, is a good work. And we must take a responsibility for that. And what Gallup then says is that there's a war for jobs coming. Their book that they brought out on this is The Coming Jobs War. And they say that the way that you fight the new war is with knowledge. And that is why, if you want to compete in the new world, then you must control knowledge. And that is why we've decided that we change the whole focus from the trade union, from only collective bargaining. We say that is all industrial techniques of trade unionism, to create knowledge. So what we now do is we empower our members with knowledge. We have, like I said, the technical college. We have the university. We pay out every year around about 40 million rand for our members in the form of study aid. And then suddenly our members simply perform better, not for the reason of skin color or what, because of the fact that the community take responsibility. And what's important here is it's not old money. Every member of ours give 10 rand a month for developmental projects. It doesn't sound a lot.
But that's not a membership fee. That's over and above.
Over and above. And we built a technical college. There's about 40 million rand of equipment there. And it was built by 10 rand of ordinary blue-collar workers. And so workers came here and said that, listen, we want to help each other, help Makar. And that is what we do. And that is powerful. And if we can carry that over to people, so it's we think it's a powerful model for South Africa to say that we take everyone do a bit, and we are not dependent on government at all.
So I like what you're saying, and I'm trying to imagine how anyone who would call themselves not a fan of Solidariteit, if they heard exactly what you said now with a different accent, and a different coming from someone of a different skin color, how they'd have any problem with that. In fact, they'd probably praise it to the hills. They'd say this is all about people getting things done, improving the knowledge base in South Africa, upskilling people, giving workers an opportunity to contribute to something meaningful for everybody, for the community. I don't see how anyone could have an argument. But you know, we live in South Africa. Mm. So someone's going to say, oh yeah, how many black members do you have in Solidariteit? Mm.
Okay.
As if that's an argument. Is it an argument?
It's not supposed to be an argument at all. And that is that thing, the difference between bonding and lager. We have black members, and we train black members. This morning when I sat outside this specific studio, I got an email from our technical college, and they sent through and say, here's some students that has real problems to pay. Can we help maybe with study aid? Can I go to our study aid center to help them? And I looked through it. 4 out of 5 were black students. Mm-hmm. And so I can go out now and help them. The irony is, 2 students at our one center of our university could not get finance from the state funding system for the reason it was dysfunctional. They came to us. We help them. They study now in our Kreersdorp Center. Another example. We have 2 students at our technical college, one black, one white. Both of them are deaf, so they can't hear. The one can read sign language, the black guy, and the white guy not. And the black student then translate with sign language the classes to the white student. Both of them now got a job opportunity at the same employer that we helped them to be placed. And so the fact of the matter is that we are thus not a lager. We say, yes, of course, we have a focus on a specific community with a specific cultural energy. And the reason why we can mobilize that is because that is where the energy lies. And but then we say, let's open. We are not thus in the classical liberal idea where where there's only a bunch of individuals, but we are not in the classic socialist collectivist idea where the collective is everything.
Yeah, because that is essentially that collectivism is the idea of the left.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone is going to call you leftists.
I don't think so. So don't call me a leftist. Don't call me a liberal.
because you probably, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but I would imagine that you are more interested in the individual than the collective on a personal level.
That's correct, yes. We have, yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
I don't want to get too politically theoretical, because otherwise things get boring. What I'd like to talk about, and I'm amazed by these examples that you're giving of the sort of work that you do at Solidariteit. What I'd really like to talk to you about, my ulterior motive, if you will, for having you in here, is to discuss sensibly and without hysteria the issue of affirmative action, which you've done a lot of work on. You did your doctorate in industrial psychology with affirmative action as the theme. You've written innumerable papers. You've spoken about this very often in public fora. So I think this is a good time for us to talk about affirmative action. South Africa is, the, as far as I know, the only country in the world where the majority of people are protected by an affirmative action regulatory framework. In most countries, affirmative action applies when a minority find themselves being less given less opportunities than the majority population, including in the United States, which is why there isn't really anything we can compare this to.
No.
So affirmative action, let's get to BEE later and the elites that we're creating later. Let's just talk about affirmative action. You mentioned these two deaf students. And the black deaf student has an ability to use sign language and the white student not, and they've ended up helping each other, which is a beautiful story. But if both of those people applied for the same job, you managed to get both of them a job. But if both of them applied for the same job, in affirmative action terms, if they were both of equal skill and competence, in affirmative action terms, you would create the space for the black person in that job first. Right. So is that what you understand South African affirmative action to be, or is it something else?
No, so South African affirmative action is even more radical than that. What boiled down, and we see it also in the regulations that was published on the affirmative action legislation last week, is that it developed in a racial quota system in the sense that everything is measured against the population of South Africa. So the underlying idea of equality is that equality only will play out when everything reflects the racial composition in South Africa in an exact way.
So hang on, does that mean in the Northern Cape, where there's a large colored population and a small black population and a moderately sized white population, those numbers aren't important to affirmative action, what would you call them, apparatchiks? They're interested in the national demographic.
Yes, the irony is that we had that case on behalf of the 10 colored applicants at the Department of Correctional Services. And although we've won the case, what came out is they called it the Barnard Principle, even in the Constitutional Court in that case. And the Barnard Principle is the principle that was laid down by the Constitutional Court in the Renata Barnard case. And that principle that was laid down was that the national racial composition must be reflected everywhere. We've won that case, but on technical issues and because we took it to court with the old Article 42 wording of the Employment Equity Act, and since then it was removed. So the argument then is that there was historical reasons why coloureds in the Western Cape is overrepresented, and that must be then addressed. So and that's the crisis. The underlying thinking of the ideology of representativity is that the natural state of South Africa will be everywhere exactly the reflection of the South African population. And if it's not there, then it means it's unequal. And there's a reason for. There was a systemic reason for that. And that systemic reason must be addressed. So the end goal will be
so
national representation.
What they're trying to
everything.
Do here is create an equality of outcome rather than an equality of opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely so. We call it then output-based affirmative action and versus what we call input-based affirmative action. And I think that's the simple difference. And the interesting thing is we've done a lot of – I've done
– What if black people who attend university in, I don't know, Garankuwa, wherever – aren't as interested, let's just say that there are less black people applying to be engineers at a certain institution. Does that mean that that institution now has to either cajole black people into joining or turn away as many whites as they can until they get those numbers right?
Yeah, the argument
is that what they want?
The argument is then there's a systemic problem and that must be addressed.
But that can't be true. I mean, for example, there aren't a lot of women working in the mines. There are very few women mine workers inside the mines. It's because it's not a very pleasant environment for anyone who might want to have children or might not want to be sexually harassed. There are a number of reasons that that could come into it. I don't want to get into the details of that, but if there aren't, if half the mine workers aren't women, are these people going to be up in arms? And by these people, I mean the policymakers.
Yeah. You argue this much better than I can. So, but of course, you are quite correct. That is why we say there's a fundamental flaw in the thinking in the South African affirmative action. And that is why it's not working, because there's a fundamental flaw. The answer for affirmative action in South Africa, and let me just put it on the table, I'm quite convinced, and there's no issue, that there's inequalities in South Africa, and there's historic reasons for inequalities in South Africa.
You're not denying the reality.
Not at all. The question is rather, how do we address that? In what we propose, and it's not us that's proposing that, the United Nations Development Report, Human Development Report proposed that, the Committee for the Eradication of All Forms of Racial Discrimination proposed that. And I can give a lot of other examples as well. The International Labour Organization, they all propose what we call input-based affirmative action, where you focus on skills development, where you say that I empower a person to enter the labor market, and then there's a responsibility on that individual. And we focus quite strongly on that element of affirmative action.
That makes sense. So input-based affirmative action is about, if you want to do a certain thing and you don't have the requisite skills, there should be means by which you can skill yourself in order to do that thing that you want. Output-based affirmative action doesn't care what your skill level is, as long as the demographics are all representative of the total demographics of South Africa.
Yeah,
is that right?
That's right. Yes, we had a case that was an Indian lady in the police service, and this specific case, they use literally a calculator, and they then. And that was in court, testified in court. And then they used this calculator and they said on this specific job level, in this, make a calculation on how many Indians are there in the country, etc. And that was here in South Africa.
Isn't that the very definition of racism?
Yeah. And then their outcome was, if we look at the calculator, the ideal figure, that's the wording, the ideal figure for Indian women on this specific job level is zero. And so they did not then appoint this lady.
They don't want this woman because she's an Indian woman. It doesn't matter if she is the best person for the job. Taken to extremes, this is the definition, the very definition of racism. Yeah. Excluding an Indian woman because in that demographic, on the calculator, she doesn't have a place. Mm. The problem I have here is, let's say that Boere Orkester, an O-Afrikaanse Boere Orkest, was one of the important industries in South Africa. Yeah. Just imagine for argument's sake, in this case, that it was. I don't know a lot of black people who love Boere Musiek, just because it's not culturally relevant to them for whatever reason. They weren't historically exposed to it, perhaps. It's just not something that appeals to a lot of black people. I certainly don't know one Afrikaanse Boere Orkest member who's black. Just happens to be the case. If this form of affirmative action is applied to all Boere Orkester, 80% of the members of each Boere Orkest need to be black. Makes zero sense.
It makes zero sense. It does not allow for any diversity. Sport is a good example, because if we want to force down quotas in sport, it is as if all communities play all sports equally. In America, a good example is the basketball teams are about 100% black.
Yeah. And they're one or two token whites.
Yeah. And there's absolutely loyalty of all Americans.
Right. The audiences are very mixed.
Yeah, the audience. And everyone is loyal and etc. You know. So, and that's the problem. So, the principal problem here is there's a kind of a quota mathematical method. And then we take out the people. And what we say, no, that is not affirmative action anymore.
Isn't there another problem with this? And maybe I'm doing some of your work for you here, which wasn't my intention. But on what basis do we measure this? I mean, you can break it down and break it down and break it down. If we take the national demography, which they use in policymaking, what if we took municipal demography? What if we took, I mean, at what point does it become acceptable to individualists?
Yeah.
There isn't a point, really, until you get down to the single person. Mm-hmm. And even then, there isn't, because now you don't have an equation. You don't have a mean to compare it to because it's one person to one person. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like a sensible way to treat people. It seems like the most dehumanized way to treat people.
Yeah.
You take no account of the individual. It is entirely about what race they're from.
Yeah.
Rather than who they are as a person. This is removing dignity from someone. Surely there's a legal basis for that argument.
Yeah. Well, we are now in litigation for about 12 years on affirmative action. We drove 32 cases. And there was an interesting shift. We started with all our arguments and on a very sound, let's say, liberal argument, because the liberal, the constitution is actually based on sound liberal values, and the arguments that we use is used was the classical non-racial arguments, and we started to win cases, case by case.
Yeah,
and suddenly, from about 3-4 years ago, everything changed. The whole atmosphere in the court around this changed, and that was. The political environment changed around us, and so did the legal environment.
So are you saying that the lawyers and the courts and the whole judicial system became less liberal?
With no doubt.
Okay, what did they change into? What did it start morphing into?
What we now see is, if we can call that first phase, the phase of non-racialism, we see this actually as a phase of racialism, or we can also say multiracialism, where there's suddenly, again, we strive to have South Africa divided exactly in all racial terms and racial norms. And we've seen that in the Constitution, even in the Constitutional Court, that the whole there's a whole change in judgments. So suddenly this quota system idea and this measurement against the national demographics became the legal norm. And that's a headache for us at this stage. In fact, we had a consultation with a senior counsel yesterday on a specific case that we had. And he said to us, because he's involved in 12 years of litigation with us now, a very liberal guy. In fact, he was Kusatu's lawyer for long, so he was actually on the left side, not even on the liberal side. And he said to us, listen, the idea of national demographics is now so strong, he's not convinced that we must go to court anymore to try to defend the old non-racial idea. That was his advice. And so we, for example, have this case of the Sasol empowerment scheme now. In the Sasol empowerment scheme, they had one scheme, Izalo, and that specific scheme was inclusive of all workers, blue-collar workers from a specific point upward, downwards. And now they design a new scheme. That old scheme ran out. And the new scheme is now 100% exclusive. 100% exclusive. All those white workers are now excluded. So that's the change in the narrative in the past couple of months. And, well, if we listen now to Mr. Ramaphosa, etc., we hope that there will be a new face. But the unfortunate thing is, political climate influence the legal framework.
Yes,
as well.
And obviously that has repercussions across the board. But people should be in a position, no matter where they come from, how little or how much they have, or what race they belong to, they should have the opportunity to pursue their own interests, to be able to go into a job. I got a call this morning from a guy he's a black guy who wants to be a pilot, but he's in Limpopo somewhere, far from any flying school and without any resources to do so. That doesn't mean he should give up on that. Just as it shouldn't it would be a horrible thing for some skilled white person to not be able to find a usefulness in the government if they wanted to work for this government. Where do you, Dirk, draw the line between social engineering of the kind that ultimately this equality of outcome, if you will, results in, a Stalinist type social engineering? Where do you draw the line between that kind of result and the sort of result where we take no recognition of the past and the inequality and we just let people, pardon my use of the language, fuckfurt?
Yeah.
I mean, where is it? Somewhere in the middle?
Yeah. Well, in the first place, the moment that you use a calculator to determine people's future, then there's no human involved anymore. Then it's social engineering. So you say this number of people here, etc. That's a cold clinical way. And that we take an issue on. On the other hand, we must say that how can we develop people? How can we invest in people? What can we do to address the issue of 80 to 85% of schools that's dysfunctional? The problem is that skills pipeline that comes from that schools are not representative of South Africa.
The negative side, the dark side of the moon to this positive, if I were a black person in South Africa, I would probably be very pro-affirmative action, just on the face of it. But on closer inspection, as a black person in South Africa, I would want to pursue my own interests. And this system of demography might force me into something I don't want to do, just as it may force out the white person who does want to do that. So there's a negative side to this which we're not talking about.
We had a case, a solidarity case, on behalf of a black employee in Eskom. Mm-hmm. And we've settled that now with Eskom outside court. But in this specific case, not Eskom, DCS, Correctional Services. And in this specific case, they used the national demographics. This black guy applied for the job. Mm-hmm. And they said to them, there's a under-representation of black women in that specific job level. And this black guy, according to affirmative action, did not get the job. That's absurd. That's absolutely absurd because they used a calculator. So this was not about any affirmative action anymore. That is only about the representativity. And that is our issue. We've won the case through a settlement at the end of the day, but the fact of the matter is we had to go to court to defend this black
guy. Now, that's an interesting case, and we're digressing a little, but I want you to answer this. A lot of people would say, oh, you only took that case on because it would get you political points. What do you say to those people?
If we take on a case, we look at the principle and we say we must fight the principle. That principle does not know color. It did not know color when we took it on behalf of the colored employees in the Western Cape. It did not know color when we took the case of Renata Barnard, a white woman. It did not any color when we took it on behalf of a black male and Indian workers, etc. So we choose a principle and we will drive that principle. And that specific principle does not know color.
All right. So affirmative action in South Africa is still massively complicated. And for an employer, for someone who's just trying to follow the law, is it made easier or more difficult by changes to the legislation, by constant regulatory imperatives, by sometimes a lack of certainty? How hard is it making it for people to employ people? We always look at it, and you will as a union, you'll look at it sometimes from the point of view of the worker, but how difficult is it for people who want to create employment, which is probably our biggest challenge in the country?
The more regulation, the less employment. The more central control, the less economy. And it also can also be applied to issues like affirmative action. The more that it is forced down, the lesser affirmative action there will be. Because it's more difficult to appoint. So while we say is, we know employers, and that is our experience through and through, want to appoint and develop much, much more black South Africans, because the fact of the matter is there's not enough white South Africans in South Africa to drive the economy.
The market will dictate that
anyway. The market will dictate that. And if we then say, let's develop a skills base through training and development, etc., I think that there will be even more transformation if companies are even a bit more free. Because at this stage, it's so regulated.
But the government says the opposite. They say, oh no, left to their own devices, all these white-owned companies or white monopoly capital, whatever other made-up term it is, they'll say those people will keep excluding blacks on purpose.
Yeah, but why? I try to think, what will be the reason for that?
Maybe because they hate black people, is what the government might say.
The interaction that we have, listen, I'm not here on behalf of the white elite. In fact, in a lot of cases, I'm fighting them as well, so I don't want to defend them. I get the opposite vibe from them. They do a lot to try to accommodate. I think sometimes to an extent that it's only politically correctness. You know, they sometimes I tell you go too far. It's not natural anymore. Hmm. So my experience is that they actually do more than anyone will expect from them. Sometimes just to be correct, I think that is what Sasol is doing now with the empowerment transaction. It's not by heart, it's by economic.
So how's that case going? And what's happening with Sasol?
Well, we are now in dispute with Sasol on this one because they designed a specific structure, and that's an empowerment structure. And the irony of that one is, in the first place, they exclude the white workers in total. The black workers will get, in the middle of the year, June, share value of around about 500,000 rand. The white guy will get nothing. So you will get there at the workplace in June. Both of you are artisans. And then suddenly the colleague next to you get 500,000 rand and you get nothing. And that is going to lead to a lot of racial tension.
It could lead to very real-world physical consequences too. I mean, that happens anywhere in the world where two people who are doing the same job
Find
out that they're not being paid the same.
They created a thing there that will lead to tension. And then the irony of that is, and then they take this empowerment scheme and they take it to the JSE to trade there, but there's a segment on the JSE that they call the empowerment segment. Only blacks can trade with blacks there. Mm-hmm. And the reason why they take it there, because they don't want the black employees to sell it to the open in the open market, because then they sell it again to white people, and then their empowerment rating drop again.
Because if white people buy it, they can take the dividends.
Yes. And now they want it only to blacks to trade.
So who wants to have their money controlled by these kinds of structures? I mean, who doesn't want control of their money? That's crazy.
The system control them.
But who wants any system to control their money? What kind of people want that? Yeah. If you're a black person who has... Let's say you've earned your 500,000 rand and you want to now put it somewhere else, or you want to sell it to someone. Shouldn't you be allowed to?
Well, here's the problem now, that the black guys that get that money, their shares are watered down because they can only be traded on the black segment.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because Sasol wants their transformation points.
This is like in apartheid when a black person couldn't buy a house outside of a township.
Yeah.
The interesting thing
is that we have discussions.
You build a nice house, you can't sell your nice house in the townships and buy any house you want. You have to buy another house in the townships.
They force them to buy on that black segment.
This is Favut's biggest dream.
And the tension will come, and the paradox. We have discussions this week to come with the Kusatu Trade Union on this, and we're going to find each other. The whites are excluded 100%, but the blacks are, I think, the black workers are used so that they can get points so that they can do transactions as a big company. While the answer...
But that's patronizing.
It's absolutely patronizing. It's absolutely patronizing. But the answer, I think, would be if they come and say, listen, there's an economic rationale to give shares for workers because you'll align workers then with the mission of the company. So let's design a share scheme for workers that's inclusive because then everyone is happy. From a specific point lower down, most of them will be black workers because of the round, in this specific case, around about 75%, I think, of the workers in this scheme would have been black. So it is, of course, black empowerment as well, but we do it inclusive. We align the workers, and then you have an economic rationale because then suddenly I have an interest as a worker for the company to perform. But what did they do now? They took out that rationale, and it became a clinical transaction for the sake of getting points. That simply does not work. There's economic rationale for employee share ownership schemes. That's not racial. It's not necessary to be racial.
Well, I mean, I remember watching the MTN price slide down and down and down, and with it went those empowerment schemes of MTNs. And I thought, for all those poor black people, because it was mostly poor black people who'd invested in that and who were allowed to invest in it because there weren't any other people allowed to invest in it.
Yeah.
They just see their money becoming less and less and less valuable over time, which seems to me to benefit nobody except the company that's created this as a front to make them look like they're doing good things.
Yes, and they get their points.
Yeah.
And
so surely this should irk any proud black person as much as it would the land issue or an issue of racial discrimination in the workplace or any such other thing. This is blatant use of someone just by virtue of the fact that they're black for the purposes of a company and their PR.
Yeah, that's absolutely how we experience this as well. And that is how we had discussions yesterday with Sasol on this, and and that is exactly what we carry over. The end of this transaction will be frustrated black employees and frustrated white employees because they are excluded. But remember, in June, these black workers will get shares worth of 500,000 rand. And then with that, a loan facility worth of 500,000 rand. That means that in June, they have nothing. And then in the next 10 years, they must pay then the shares via dividends. So they get a loan that must be repaid via dividends of the shares. So
actually, they're getting less than nothing.
What can happen then is in 10 years' time, the share value can fall and you can have nothing.
I don't know why, other than these points. Do these points allow Sasol to transact with anyone in particular?
Yes, with the state.
The state.
Yeah, with the state. And remember,
it's a short-term view.
Yeah, that's a problem with the state.
And
as
this
well.
Is a fossil fuel company.
Yeah.
I mean, in the future, a fossil fuel company, look, they also do industrial research and they do chemical research, and there's a lot of value in Sasol. But their long-term future is not going to be guaranteed the way that it might have in the 1980s or 90s or even 2000s because of the development of renewable energy and that sort of thing. Sasol's kind of an old school company in many respects.
Yeah.
It's highly likely their share price will go down.
Yeah.
It's highly likely that these workers who they're now appearing to bless with this wonderful providence will end up poorer than they are now. And if their transaction, the main transactions they conduct are with the state, that's also a very inhibited view of what their success might be.
Okay, let's look at the...
Who's running this thing?
Yeah, let's look at the biggest critique that I have against all that we said now. And that is that we sit with a system problem. And that is that the system actually controls everything. But what happens now? The system enslaved... black workers and young black people as well, because they started to believe that I can only be successful through the system. We had a discussion on black economic empowerment with a group of top black entrepreneurs, And I was the only white at the dinner party. And and then we had discussions. And then one guy said that, can you believe there's successful black entrepreneurs that say it's because of themselves and not because of the system. They betray the system. And then Jimmy Manji was there as well. And he said, he was then at the Black Black Management Forum. And he said then, yes, at the BMF, we call them house niggers. Now, I was just amazed because they are protecting the system. And while what I see is a lot of black South Africans that's successful because of themselves, not the system.
Yes,
but if you come at the stage where you say that I'm dependent on the system, then you are enslaved. On the other hand, what I experience among young white guys, they sit with a problem. They can't use the system anymore. And then suddenly they become entrepreneurs and they are successful.
Well, you also hear a lot of white people who say, oh, the system won't, I can't get it. And then they leave and they go and live somewhere else and they end up having these very average lives.
Yeah.
And that's also, you know, it depends on your philosophy. Someone like Jimmy Manji, and he, I think, is largely discredited now. Mm. I don't think that there are very many people who want to listen when Jimmy Manji wants to speak, because we know he was an agent of the Guptas, and that this whole facade, this whole farce that is ANN7 and everything that he's done, even before he did this at the Black Management Forum, Jimmy Manji was really hot air.
Yeah, he was the guy also that said on TV that the coloureds in the Western Cape, if they they want to get to work, they must embark on a great trek from the Western Cape to the rest of South Africa, a system approach. And that is the thing that we must all fight against in South Africa, black and white, etc., that we must not be enslaved by a system anymore, because that's just a continuation of an old system.
But in some ways, this relates to the Sasol situation, is that the future is not going to be a future of big government state systems.
No.
We see decentralization as an obvious outcome of technology and of people being able to connect to each other in ways that we didn't have the possibility of doing before. We see an international collaborative approach. We see people forming smaller, more potent forces in the future, smaller cells than these large, unwieldy coagulations of what we call countries.
Oh, that's why there's debates on the end of the nation states.
Do you welcome those debates, or are you
absolutely? The more federal we can go, the more responsibility on the lowest level possible, the more successful will we be. The problem that we...
So you're not a nationalist?
I'm not a nationalist at all. In fact, we have great critique against the old nationalist ideas that led to a big state with an apartheid system that tried to control everything. That's our big control against our critique against the apartheid system as well. We, as a movement, wants to do exactly the opposite. But the problem that we see in South Africa at this stage, the more the tendency global to less state, the more state we see. If we listen to Ramaphosa's State of the Nation address, it was an address of state.
Yes,
more state.
Isn't that just a natural pushing back against what's inevitable?
Yeah, I think so. Although I think he's a sophisticated socialist.
Yes, well, I mean, he's a socialist nonetheless, and many people are in this country, and many of them are because the system that they were brewed in, that they were indoctrinated through, the system that they found themselves in circumstantially by virtue of the time they were born. Many of our leaders, black and white, the only thing that they knew was what the apartheid government had created as their reality. Mm. So they're still working on the basis, and perhaps some would say erroneously, working on the basis of that system and trying to use that system even to make things better or worse. That's the basis. And I think many people would say, if you really want to free people, if you really want to change things, you must entirely eliminate all those systems, including state centricism of the old regime.
Mm.
Because perhaps that's the thing that keeps people most underfoot.
Absolutely so. Because the fact is,
the party doesn't change a damn thing.
Yeah.
If the underlying substructure is still one that was invented by people like Malan and Verwoerd, then nothing has changed.
Well, yes, the irony is that the idea of the Big Brother is actually a strong colonialist idea that was carried over on the nationalists, and they used the old colonial ideas that they fought against to develop a new system. But now there's a continuation of that in more state nationalistic kind of systems using social engineering, and it's carried it over in the new government. So there's a line of continuation there. And that's a bit of the irony.
You see, isn't it just also this is a systematic illness, because the kind of people who want to be in politics are the kind of people who actually want to keep that system alive.
Yes, of course.
Just because it gives them access to the public purse.
Yeah.
They don't have to do anything meaningful. They don't have to change society for the better. They just have to look for a job like a parasite where they'll be paid to do nothing.
Mm.
All right. I want to go to some specifics here. You did, and you mentioned the colonial system. You actually wrote a letter to Prince William in 2017 where you said to him, I just want to let you know what the British did to the Afrikaners in the Anglo-Boer War, because it was the foundation of – it was the first ever use of concentration camps, right? And the atrocities that were committed by the British are things that are not spoken of very much now because it's over 100 years ago.
Mm.
But these are things that – did you ever get a reply from Prince William?
No. I thought he would come and drink some tea, but he –
Not even a reply. Not even a receipt.
Not even a reply.
Okay. When you went after Brian Molefe and Ben Gubane, and that was just very recently, did you immediately get a response, or do we know what the status is there in terms of action from here on in? Because you went after them because they got paid – pensions. Subsequently, even Eskom has said that those pensions shouldn't have been paid.
That's correct, yes. Well, we took it to court, and I must say I was so impressed with the three judges. And if I can say it's a best bit tongue in the kiss, they were fully transformed.
So they were black judges.
they were black. Okay. And it was just an excellent judgment. And that gave me hope. And that sent out such a strong message to all in South Africa that I think the South African society is fed up with this kind of actions where you just award yourself in a meeting where you don't even declare your own interest in that meeting, and you award yourself a pension of
30 million rand.
30 million rand. And Ben Gubane, he actually cahoots in that. He was in circus. And that was but the fact of the matter is that we've won that, and that is the kind of thing that we've won, and where I think the outcome of that is a better South Africa for all.
Well, it is, and you've been vindicated by Eskom themselves now.
Yes.
Agreeing with what you did.
Absolutely, yeah. While they originally they opposed, and then at the end of the day, not.
I need to ask you about the Spur restaurants, because this is something that was very controversial at the time. There was that racial incident. A white guy and a black woman, as I recall, had an argument or an altercation in Spur. And it became first an issue of Spur doesn't treat black people with respect. Then it became an issue of they said no, that the Spur restaurant said that the white guy was the one who was at fault or something like that. Yeah. It ended up becoming a boycott. And before we knew it, there were places where Spur was being boycotted by Afrikaans people.
Mm.
I mean, the details of that whole story aren't even important anymore.
Yeah.
What was your takeout from this, and what was your position on it?
Let me just... So where I got involved, when I've seen that specific incident, it was such a disgusting kind of incident. Two adults shouting at each other and
with their children watching.
With children watching and so on. So I was so irritated with that, I did nothing. All right. And then about 2 months or so later, I listened to Pierre Fontaine, the CEO of Spur, and he said then there was... you talk about on 702 about the a boycott. At that stage, we were not involved at all. But what irritated me then, he took and then issued and he said that he experienced that the people that boycott Spur are all conservatives, and then he said they are the typical people that live in the moot in Pretoria. So he then just generalized, and that irritated. Well, I live in the moot, and I wrote to them a letter, and I said to them, listen, don't generalize. I listened to you, and I lost my appetite to eat at Spur, not because of the incident, but in the because of the
Spur's
way
reaction,
the reaction and the way that they handled it, and that irritated me. And then it was just the reaction was just amazing on that open letter that I wrote to Pierre van Tonder, and then it sparked everything. And then suddenly it became a symbol of people that feel that we feel estranged, we feel frustrated, etc. And it became a symbol of something else than the incident. I could not find anyone that actually wants to defend the white guy, but also not the black lady. Mm. So it wasn't about that incident. It was, at the end of the day, something else.
So that thing, that something else, do you think it has to do with a white guy is in charge of a big company who is trying to defend his company from something that happened by chance in that restaurant? Could have happened anywhere else, and it would have been that other company's problem. And in doing so, overcompensates by trying to make it an issue for them to be politically correct on? Or do you think that this is something which is a microcosm of what South Africa is at the moment, in that we haven't resolved some of our racial tensions and we don't know how to?
Okay. Well, I'm not that sure that we haven't resolved our racial tensions. I know there's a lot of racial tension at this stage in South Africa. But if we look at orderly relationships in South Africa between black and white, my experience is it's actually more healthy than we present it on social media and in the media, etc.
The Institute of Racial Relations.
The Institute of Racial Relations.
Bear you out on this.
That's their research show by far that the racial relations in South Africa is much, much better than we think. That isn't the first
place. Than they've ever been. But there's also, you turn on the radio, which I don't do very often anymore, you turn on the TV, you go on social media, there's an overrepresentation of racial incidents because obviously they spark controversy and interest. And for most people in the media, it's about clicks, it's about likes, it's about interactions and engagements, because that gives them the audience that they can then sell to advertisers. Mm. And nobody thinks that's suspicious.
Well, yeah, of course, yes. And the other side of the coin, of course, is that while there's still a focus on incidents, it means it's not the norm. If it was, this is what South Africa is, it would not have been in the news headlines. The moment that there's still news on it, it means that it's still news.
In other words, for you, the irony is that every racial incident that is reported would indicate to you that there are actually mostly harmonious and good relations.
That's correct, yes, because this is the abnormal. But the Spur incident was in the midst of a whole lot of other things that happens, where what we say there was double standards with racism. And
it was also in the midst of a cynical campaign by an international public relations agency, which was funded by state capture agents in order to distract us from people whose hands were in the till and who were doing us genuine harm, when there was a perceived harm that you could create that would cause
controversy. The Spur incident was just in the middle of that specific campaign. So I wrote a piece on that, and I said that the Spur incident is a result of the campaign. That is what happened. That is the tension that they succeeded to create it in South Africa. But in general, our experience is, with no doubt, that there's a double standard if it comes to racism in South Africa.
What do you mean?
When it's a white on black kind of remark, then it will be outrageous. But when we see, and the irony of that is in the cases where there's black guys that said things about white people, it's as a rule, and we brought out a report on that, it's a rule in a vertical relationship, meaning that is officials in a vertical relationship, and there's a violent element to it. They believe whites must be killed or something. You know, that there's a lot of things that...
So in other words, the constitutional definition of hate speech.
That's hate speech. Okay. And there's a difference between then hate speech and maybe racist remarks. So in the white cases, the Penny Sparrow cases, etc., it's horizontal. It is someone from the public against someone from the public. That's horizontal. Not acceptable at all. We must not have horizontal racial...
But in other words, these are not people who necessarily have influence. Actual power over
that's
each
correct,
other.
Yeah. While on the other side, it's Julius Malema.
So these are people who have actual state influence or political power with them.
And that's the risk. That's the risk. And now we don't address it. The Human Rights Commission does not take that officials, the vertical guys, but they take the horizontal guys. And we had a whole discussion with the Human Rights Commission that we brought out a report. We use their actions as an example and showed them everything. Well, ironically, their reaction was they wrote us a letter and they said that they will consider to use the legislation to their possession to take us criminally to court because of our report on the Human Rights Commission. And the two guys at our research institute that wrote the report, and it's a real good objective report, got a letter from the Human Rights Commission and say that they consider criminal proceedings against them.
On what basis? What's the crime?
We went to them and asked them, okay, just explain as to us.
Because what's the crime?
The crime is we brought in this discredit institution of the Constitution.
But if the Human Rights Commission, surely any member of the public is allowed to ask questions of the Human Rights Commission.
Well, they bullied us. So we went to them, we had discussions with them on that. We asked them, okay, can you just show us the factual inaccuracies? And okay, they will now come back to us with the factual inaccuracies.
But this is, you know what this is? This is just identity politics gone wild. Mm. Because the fact that a Penny Sparrow should get so much more attention than when an actual politician says something about white people, who cares about a Penny Sparrow? As you rightly point out, she doesn't really have power in society. But she caused all this controversy because in identity politics the philosophy, the doctrine is that you belong to a group which is oppressed. And that group identity is the most important thing about you, not your individual capacity to decide not to be upset. In other words, other people are deciding for you, you should be upset.
Yes.
This is obviously where solidarité has to be really careful.
Yes.
And that's why I bring it back to you. If you become identitarian, you risk making yourselves as stupid as the people who would say that a Penny Sparrow is more dangerous than an official who's abusing their power over someone in an oppressive manner. And that's something that I'm very concerned about because I do believe that the sign of a healthy democracy, and we should all celebrate the fact that there's a solidarité, whether we agree with you or not, because the very idea of a healthy democracy is represented in organizations which can take a minority view, which can defend the small man, which can speak out against the abuse of state power, and where it can introduce opportunities that might be outside of the state for people inside the system and give them another opportunity to look at things a different way. I think what you guys are doing is terrific. I think you're an important organ of a non-political organ of state that is not only concerned with workers' rights, but also with unfair practices. I can only wish you well. Is it really tough being in solidarité? Do you feel sometimes very isolated and alone?
Yeah. If you put us in the context of the broad direction in South Africa, you feel sometimes alone and feel under pressure because we are not in line with the center politics of South Africa, and that makes it difficult. I think sometimes if I am on some radio stations, it's just the kind of abuse that I will get on a Power FM. It's abusive, and that makes it sometimes difficult, as if there's not there's not place of space for anyone that's not in line with the with the middle of the politics of South Africa. So that's sometimes difficult. Although, if I take, for example, the kind of relationships that we have with employers, and in most cases nowadays, employers are run in the HR departments, etc., run by black South Africans. Yesterday, we had the meeting of Sasol. The meeting was led by a black lady, a very senior vice president of Sasol, and she was just so open and nice. We could have an open discussion on a very difficult issue like Sasol. And I have appreciation for that. If I look at our relationships with, you know, ironically, with individuals within the ANC, with NUM, with NUMSA, etc., then I must say that in that general terms, we don't feel isolated.
I'm glad to hear that. I mean, I've had my reasons to disagree with you in the past. I didn't entirely like the track that you guys chose for the Tumi Morake issue. Mm. First of all, because I'm partisan, I happen to know and like Tumi. Yeah. Second of all, I've been a broadcaster for a long time, so I know what it's like to come up against that kind of crap when you're on the inside. You're just trying to do a job and be funny every morning.
Yeah.
And I also know that she is a good person, and I haven't ever experienced anything like a dislike of white people from Tumi. When she says things, she's often trying to be funny, and that's her job. So I had disagreements with you guys on that one, and I probably will continue to disagree with you on it. That doesn't mean you shouldn't exist. And I think it would be a good thing for South Africa if we had more discussions with people in solidarity who find themselves so often outside of the mainstream media. So I thank you for coming to spend some time with me this morning.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Dirk. There he is, Dirk Herman, who's the chief executive of the Solidariteit trade union. And he's someone who I think we will be able to reflect interestingly on when it comes to topics and subjects like affirmative action. We didn't even get into BEE. We didn't get much into the politics and where he feels that the different political parties might play a role. But we'll have time again with Dirk in the future. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
This is CliffCentral.com.